Welcome to the Blue Ocean Church Ann Arbor Lenten podcast. I'm Emily, one of the co-pastors of Blue Ocean, and this is part 2 of 6. I'll begin by giving you a brief summary of chapter 2 of The Cross and the Lynching Tree by James Cone. I'll follow that with a couple of questions to think about during the week and end with a time of meditation. I do want to make one quick note, though, before I begin, that the word Negro comes up in 2 different quotes that I use today. And I'm only using it in the context of exact quotes so as not to misrepresent the sources. And the 2 people that I use who quote it are Reinhold Niebuhr and Martin Luther King Jr. Chapter 2 is titled The Terrible Beauty of the Cross in the Tragedy of the Lynching Tree. And this entire chapter is dedicated to interacting with the life and teachings of Reinhold Niebuhr. Reinhold was a prominent Christian ethicist and a public theologian. He also had a brother named Richard. Both of them were well-known ethicists. Richard taught at Yale Seminary, and Reinhold taught at Union Theological Seminary, where James Cone also eventually taught. Reinhold Niebuhr was probably the more well-known of the 2 brothers, and he was a recognizable figure in the country at large in the mid-20th century. Martin Luther King Jr. was famously influenced by Reinhold's work and personally invited him to the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965. And the only reason that Reinhold didn't participate was because he had had a stroke that prevented him from physically being able to manage it. The main issue that the 2 brothers, Richard and Reinhold, disagreed on was whether resorting to violence was ever an option for Christians. So Richard was an ardent pacifist, while Reinhold ascribed to what we call just war theory, which is a set of principles meant to make violence the absolute last resort in cases where war might be the best option out of a list of terrible options. So if I understand Reinhold Niebuhr correctly, he viewed the Gospels as promoting nonviolence, but found that he could hold the idealistic view in one hand while holding an earthier, you know, like, but sometimes life is an ideal value in the other hand. And he could hold those 2 things in tension. And both Richard and Reinhold's viewpoints are respected takes within Christianity. Now, Reinhold Niebuhr may well be the most famous American theologian to date. He actually just passed away in 1971, so a little bit before I was born. And I think that James Cone decided to interact with Reinhold Niebuhr's work for this chapter for a couple of reasons. For one, he genuinely admires Niebuhr's theological work. So Cone taught a class on Niebuhr at Union Seminary for many years, and he talks about how Niebuhr's writings on justice and power were highly influential for his own thinking about the cross. But the other reason he focuses on Reinhold Niebuhr in this chapter is because Niebuhr represents everything that frustrates Cone about white liberals. And I think this is important for us to hear, those of us who are white. So let's start with what Cone revered in Niebuhr's work. He respected Niebuhr's bent towards seeking justice for the oppressed. As a young pastor in Detroit, before he taught in a seminary, Reinhold Niebuhr championed the working class, and he wrote about racial justice. Additionally, Niebuhr saw the cross as the central lens for Christianity, and he viewed it through the lens of power. He said that we humans, who are self-interested and desirous of power, we might look for a God who is also self-interested and desirous of power. But, Niebuhr said, the cross actually reveals the opposite. It reveals a selfless God, a God willing to lay down all power and self-interest. And Niebuhr felt that the image of the cross contained such ultimate religious truth that what he called the terrible beauty of the cross could only be conveyed through poetry, that no human could adequately articulate such mystery short of prose. So Cone said this about Niebuhr. He said, few could speak with such eloquence about the cross as Reinhold Niebuhr. When I, James Cone, read his sermons and other theological reflections on the cross, I could almost be listening to a black preacher who can take a congregation through the power of imagination to the foot of Jesus' cross. And yet, Cone goes on to ask, was there not a limit to Niebuhr's imagination? Cone says Niebuhr's whiteness blinded him to the most obvious parallel to the cross in his own time, the lynching tree. And that even as a prominent theologian with deep sympathies toward the oppressed, and with the intellectual framework that could encompass such an understanding, that Reinhold Niebuhr, with all of the right tools, couldn't connect the cross with the lynching tree because his whiteness blinded him to it. Or else his fear kept him from speaking about it. And Cone says that this is why blacks needed to develop their own theology separate from the white establishment, because whites couldn't see connections that were just so blatantly obvious to black people. So with his pragmatic and earthy approach to Christian ethics, with his focus on starting with the messy facts of the time and not starting with an unachievable ideal, he says that Reinhold should have seen that connection, but he couldn't, even though everything about his training and his approach to theology should have set him up to see it clearly. Which then leads Cone to critique Niebuhr, asking why he and other white progressive Protestants couldn't fully understand the plight of black Americans. Cone's critiques essentially come down to these two things. One, that Niebuhr was seeped in a culture of white supremacy that caused him to have significant blind spots in his theology. And two, that Niebuhr experienced privilege as a white pastor and theologian, which made him more invested in keeping the current system from changing too fast than in helping reimagine the systems themselves. So let's break down these two intertwined things through Cone's lens. Cone says Niebuhr had one foot in understanding black oppression, and one foot in upholding American myths about the virtue and honor of white leadership through the years. So on page 38, Cone writes this of Niebuhr. He says, unlike Malcolm X, Niebuhr says that the founding fathers, despite being slaveholders, were virtuous and honorable men and certainly no villains. They merely bowed down to the need for establishing national unity based on a common race and a common language. He even says that the 1869 Supreme Court doctrine of separate but equal, which made Jim Crow segregation legal in the South, was a very good doctrine for its day, since it allowed the gifted members among the ex-slaves, a quote-unquote culturally backward people, to show, as a few had done in sports and the arts, irrefutable proof that these deficiencies were not due to innate inferiorities. In my view, this is in Cone's view, these latter views amount to moral justification of slavery and of Jim Crow. So in other words, Niebuhr felt that white comfort should be the primary consideration when it came to freeing the oppressed, which was all good and well for white people during the Jim Crow era. But in the meantime, human beings were suffering greatly and dying. And it's this dichotomy of acknowledging black suffering and having the theology that claims this oppression is immoral, balanced with an attitude that black people should just have to wait for history to gradually take its course, that frustrates Cone. You know, Niebuhr wrote, well, we can hardly blame Negroes for being impatient with the counsel for patience in view of their age-long suffering under the white man's arrogance. Yet the fact that it is not very appealing to the victims of a current injustice doesn't make it any less the course of wisdom in overcoming historic injustices. So in other words, regardless of what is right, slow is wise, is what Niebuhr wrote. Slow is prudent. Just be patient. And this very attitude reminds me of what also frustrated Martin Luther King Jr. when he wrote A Letter from a Birmingham Jail. He tried explaining to white pastors that their pleas for King to slow down and to stop doing things that make white people uncomfortable wasn't an option after hundreds of years of oppression. You know, the moral arc of the universe may bend toward justice, but it won't do it on its own. In Letter from a Birmingham Jail, Martin Luther King wrote, he said, we know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was quote-unquote well-timed, in view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I've heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see, with one of our distinguished jurists, that justice too long delayed is justice denied. Cohn postulates that the main reason that Reinhold Niebuhr can't seem to understand why be patient feels patronizing is a lack of empathy. That, yeah, he's seeped in a culture of white supremacy, and that creates blind spots. But that also, in spite of his intellectual understanding of justice and of the cross, Niebuhr just isn't able to fully place himself in the shoes of a black person in order to imagine how it feels to exist as a black person in American culture. As Cohn says, he said, Niebuhr had eyes to see black suffering, but I believe that he lacked heart to feel it as his own. And Cohn goes on to contrast Reinhold Niebuhr with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian who died in a Nazi concentration camp. And in Solus Jesus, I actually bring this aspect of Bonhoeffer to the forefront as well, that when Dietrich Bonhoeffer spent a year studying in the United States, actually at Union Seminary as well, Bonhoeffer attended a black church in Harlem, and he spent some time traveling throughout the South, and he was able to truly empathize with the plight of black Americans to the point of it transforming how he suffered and died on behalf of the oppressed in Germany. You know, empathy is foundational for Christian ethics. We're told that Jesus emptied himself and became a human like us and suffered, and that we serve a God who literally decided to walk in human shoes to fully understand our pain. And then in turn, we are to attempt to love others in that same way, and that that needs to be the starting point for our ethics. So that wraps up a summary of chapter 2, and we'll move on to some questions. I'll have 3 questions, and feel free to pause after each one of these as it is helpful to you. So question number 1, what are 1 to 2 things that you learned from this chapter? Question number 2, where do you feel challenged, stretched, and/or provoked? Question number 3, what are some ways that you could develop more empathy? To close out, let's take some time of silence to sit with our thoughts. And during this time, you can ask the Holy Spirit if there's anything that she would like to say to you in this space. Feel free to pause until you're done, and then I'll have the closing song, Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday, to end the podcast.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter curse.